good.
Good. I am interviewing my daughter, so I'm just going to jump right in with something that I'm really curious about, your voice, about how it developed and what it is to you in your own life.
I went to school to study voice. I went to Indiana University and I studied classical vocal performance. And I got my undergraduate degree in that and then pursued opera for a number of years and then quit opera because for me there was not enough creative control there. And I think that has to do with the other side of using my voice, which is really being able to create my own work. And so after quitting, I was still living in Berlin at that point, and I had started to do some projects with my roommate at the time, who was an operatic director. We just decided, hey, there's this venue that lets you do stuff for free. Let's just put something together. So that is how Strangers in a Song came about, and that is a installation piece that has live performance components to it.
Can you talk a little bit about the concept behind Strangers in a Song and how that developed for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Sibylla, who was my collaborator, Sibylla Polsta, she and I sat down and knew that it was going to be site-specific, and we knew that we wanted to deal with this idea of the separation between the audience and the performer, and we wanted to toy with that. And then the idea of cell phones came about. And so the concept of Strangers in a Song is that you walk into a traditional art installation space. And in that space, there are going to be these areas that have been set up by each performer. The performer is not there, but the area is sort of a lounge area or whatever that performer really wanted to connote for themselves, for representing themselves and also the repertoire that they have chosen for that day. So along with the area is a phone number, and you use your cell phone to call the number, and there's a list of songs, and you order a song. It's a very, you know, dial a song, sex line operator situation. You ask for number 4, and then you get a concert through your phone. We've done it maybe 4 or 5 different times, and they were all site-specific, and the sort of idea changed a little bit every time. But the singers were always in a separate space from where the installation was, but they were still either visible or they could be heard by the public. And so there's this quality of the person making the phone call being on display as a sort of performer. And so there's voyeurism in that intimacy that's happening. And then also the public is able to see the singer, and that is a sort of voyeurism. And so we were trying to play with voyeurism and exhibitionism, or rather, I don't know that we were trying to, but it's what happened in the end.
So can people experience this? Is this to be found online or somewhere where people can see what this was like?
There is a great documentation of the performance we did at the Hebelam Ufa Theater that my friend Benny put together. And you can see that on my website.
Was it being in Berlin that changed performance for you?
It was doing work that changed my idea of my own voice.
How so?
I think I was drawn to opera because of all of the rules that are in opera. I'm a big fan of rules. And singing was something I'd always really been praised for. It was something I was good at. It was something I felt free to express within the structure of. And there was this quality about opera that feels like it is the Olympics of singing. So it's really this spiritual path to learn about oneself. It is a way of being bigger than oneself. There are a lot of elements of opera that were really compelling to me when I was studying it, and less so when I was observing it. And so when I started to create my own work, it was then that I realized that I had a lot to say.
What do you have to say?
I mean, I think it's new with every work. So after Strangers in a Song, and after quitting opera, I moved from Berlin back to Chicago. Well, back to the United States and to Chicago for the first time. And I started to direct opera as a way of implementing my aesthetic and my decision-making onto an area in which I was already comfortable. And I think one of my first loves before or alongside singing was theater. So when I was young, I did show choir. That was my way of studying voice when I was younger. And in that learning to be presentational, like, you know, certain hand gestures, certain, you know, winks of the eye, like another mom in the group would tease my hair and they'd put on crazy amounts of blush. And in Memphis, Tennessee, the competitions that were for our show choir were also the same competitions that had beauty pageants.
Much to my chagrin. That was a moment.
And so I was learning to build a stage presence through that presentational quality, because I think prior to that I was just incredibly shy as a person.
So many people, including me of course, knew you when you were such a shy girl, and you've really stepped into this very outspoken artistic life. And I'm curious about how that was created, or if it was something that was created deliberately by you, or is it just something that happened to you along the way?
Of course, there are stories I can tell about what that process was, but it more or less dances around the idea of it as opposed to really pointing to something specific. And I think it probably has something more to do with me. And I don't know that I can trace it exactly. But I do remember going to the Nutcracker every year in Memphis and really thinking, wow, that's really beautiful. Or seeing this girl in my elementary school performing in A Christmas Carol and saying, oh, I could do that. I want to do that. Acting and theater and performance, it all sort of tied together in this place of, wow, that's really beautiful. I want to participate in that.
Mm-hmm. Can you locate the shy girl?
Oh, yeah, she's still here. Like, she's still around.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think that my shyness is more related to self-doubt or social anxiety.
Mm. I'm wondering if shyness isn't exactly it, and if there's another part of the creative process for you that is quiet and introspective.
I am currently very interested in what is public and what is private. And that is coming up very much in my work, but it also is something I studied in college when I was studying modern American women's history. There was this idea of separating the public sphere and the private sphere. And so in coming into my own feminism, I was raised through your feminism, and I had to sort of find what that was for me, and I continue to find what that is for me in reading a lot of feminist theory. And looking at a lot of feminist artwork. And so even in Strangers in a Song, there was this idea of what is public and what is private. Mm-hmm. I think there is a really strong pull to that material for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you talk about the performance piece that you're directing now in Chicago?
Yeah, absolutely. It is called She Must Die. It is developed from my good friend, Brittany Lowen, who is an operatic soprano. She and I went to university together. And for myself, because every work is developed for me. And I've gotten to see her grow up through the years, both in her personal life and also as a singer. And while I was working on another piece that I sort of had to put on the shelf, this other concept came to me, and it felt very producible, and all the pieces started to come together, and we picked a venue and a date. And the work is taking four operatic arias. An aria is just a song. It is posing those in a larger structure that comments on what they are. And the arias are all, it's kind of a stereotype in opera that the soprano in the end has to die. So we're using four different operas, and in the midst of her dying over and over and over again, we're looking at questions about suicide and depression. We're examining the oppression of women historically. There is an element in there that's about a witch hunt. We're looking at herbalism and its correlation to power. And to me, there are direct lines there to birth control, which is also having to do with power. The show I think, structurally is looking at, again, that idea of public and private. Sort of the first act is a little bit, to me, it's structured a lot like the musical Hair. The first act is kind of whimsical and optimistic and funny, and then the second act really just delves into a deeper world. And the aesthetic element that I'm really looking forward to using, that will be an element that I later use in a work that I'm developing, is the old school 90s overhead projector, mm-hmm. or probably earlier than 90s.
For those of us who were tech nerds, we remember being part of the AV club.
Yes. and so I'm looking to use that as a way of contributing to the visual element has become very important to me in new work that I'm developing.
So can you talk about why the concept She Must Die got developed for you? Like, what was that process like? And in addition to the messages that are coming through, is there something that it's asking of you?
It's curious in the process to be working with friends. Brittany is a very close friend. Sydney Asher is the other half of Laura Dern, which is a band that I'm in. We are doing songs that will sandwich the operatic arias, and we're doing scenes that will highlight certain elements of the work, or will take it in a different direction. But Sydney is a very close friend. My friend Sarah, who helped do some of the promotional photography, is a very close friend. So there's this element of working with friends for, I don't think it's the first time, but it's certainly the first time to do it with this type of ambition for me and this type of intimacy, because these friends have been friends for a very long time. I've worked with other collaborators where we become friends through the process, or we've been, you know, friends for a little while and then we decide to collaborate, but to use an already established friendship and then to try and use the intimacy of that as a foundation for what you're exploring together is a really new process for me.
Well, how does that impact? How does it impact the work itself that you're consciously choosing these friendships and this intimacy?
Well, part of it is that I don't know yet because the work is incomplete. But in the process, I have noticed that there is a lot more ease to move into certain spaces, and then there's a little bit more difficulty in order to live inside of the roles that maybe you would normally live in as a director, as an actor, I think it brings a lot more ownership into the piece, so mm-hmm. that we know that we all have a voice in it of some sort. Mm-hmm. And then it's about, there's this way that the vibrations of a violin, when they're perfectly in tune, will be more reverberant. They'll have stronger overtones, and the sound will be louder, more clear. And so there's this way of matching vibrations so that we can sync up and be in tune with each other.
Is it important to you that these friendships were with women?
I think the project is very much about, I mean, the title is She Must Die. And the concept is based on these old white male composers who are long dead, who consistently wrote narratives wherein the soprano is having to pay for some, usually it's some moral issue. It's some moral issue that she has to pay for the fact that she slept with too many people. She has to die because her husband kills her. Hmm. In another, you know, she kills herself in front of her lover because he's in love with somebody else and they're about to run off together. It's a way of acknowledging the misogyny and trying to not necessarily change it entirely, but to acknowledge the history of it and then to find our own way into it that mm. would be more honest for us, but also making fun of it. And then hopefully it ends morally ambiguous.
So for that particular production, it does matter that it's women who are doing this with you.
I'm not trying to skirt the issue of gender. It's just, I think feminism can exist within all sorts of bodies. and I think it happened to be women this time. Mm-hmm. The circumstances were such that, you know, the constellation aligned, and oh, here we are. These are the people. Mm. This is it.
I'm going to go back. This is kind of a two-parter question. So first I would like to ask about what you're interested in developing right now. I think you have a performance that's in development, and it has a really interesting title. And I'm curious about what you're exploring there and what you'd like to say about it.
So that piece is a little on the shelf right now. And I don't know yet if it's a solo piece or if it's going to be a duet. Still trying to figure that aspect out as I try and figure out how much of it I want to abstract. So I initially wrote a script that was personal narrative, having to do with my early experiences of my own sexuality. The title of that work, at the moment anyway, is I Know Exactly What I'm Doing. I've always known, I just didn't trust myself before. And I think it's looking at the ways in which we are developed by other people in our lives and the cumulative effect of being a part of the world.
So you talked a little bit about coming to a pause in the development, that this is partly to spend time with feminist theorists, the work of feminist theorists. And I wonder if you can speak about that process and about why that's important to this work and just why it's important to you.
Yeah, I felt undereducated. And a friend of mine read a draft of the work and was saying, you know, this is where this lives right now, and referenced sort of Sandra Bernhardt and sort of stand up. And so I needed to take a moment to understand what I was referencing, because I wanted to really live in this interdisciplinary realm that leans on the different parts of myself. And I think a big influence for me was watching Keith Hennessy's work, Crotch. There was a way in which he was telling personal narrative that was so specific and so intellectual, but also incredibly abstracted. And I had never seen something abstracted that was that emotionally impacting.
Hmm. Chris Krause has been an influence for you as well?
To a degree. Reading I Love Dick and then watching the new series I Love Dick has been a big influence. I'm currently reading Mira Shore's Wet on painting, feminism, and art criticism. And that is really influential. It's been interesting to see and expose myself to this strongly feminist artwork that comes out of often the 70s and see how many options I have for where I can take this.
I have to say that's such a delight to hear from a feminist who got made in the 70s to see that bridge happening to this generation. It's not as if you have to fulfill anything for me, but there is a particular delight in you as my daughter taking a thread and growing it in a way that I was not able to do at 31. It's really pleasing. And I think I would say that about any of your friends as well, who I heard having this kind of discussion about, I want to reincorporate feminist theory to a personal work. I'd be absolutely delighted and thrilled with what's happening because it's such a missing piece.
And I think there are a lot of pitfalls in looking at old feminism as well, and looking at first and second wave. I think there are pitfalls in being a white person and only talking about white experience. I think the sort of stereotype of man-hating,
Or being a man, having to be a man.
Yeah, needing to wear masculinity. I'm still attracted to that personally because it's a part of who I am.
Acting in the male or dressing as the male?
I'm still interested in depicting... Oh, it's so challenging to talk about, right? Because there are works that I see where you're representing the world of misogyny as it is and amplifying that. And there's this way that it's seen as a critique of that world. But is it a critique or is it just propagating the same world? Mm-hmm. For me, I'm very interested in finding what masculinity is for me. And I even push against this idea of masculinity and femininity because it is coming out of these expectations of gender roles.
Right.
And even that binary of gender is problematic to me.
Thank you for really bringing reading and ideas to me and things that I think that I wouldn't have the confidence to begin to articulate unless I had a daughter who was exploring this alongside and ahead of me. So very broad question. What is the importance of your sexuality to you and how is it affecting your work and relationships?
I would say that my sexuality is challenging to define the boundaries of the more I think about it. Certainly my sexual expressiveness has a container that for personal reasons as well as like lawful reasons I don't bring out into the public. But I'm not coupled. I don't. Part of growing up the way I did, I was surprisingly sexually repressed despite the environment in which I grew up in. Not society-wise, but certainly in our household and without religion. And so I think a lot of what my sexuality is learning what I want, learning what my turn-ons are, and understanding that those are going to change, knowing what my turn-offs are, and knowing that those are going to change. Just trying to stay in touch with my body. And I think there's a curious way in which sexuality is also about, and it's not, I don't even consider it sexuality. I think it's more of a political part of me, but other people would say it was sexual. And that's just talking about sex. And that's just, you know, being very explicit in terms of, you know, this is what this was. This is exactly how it went down. Like really talking about the details of something. And that's what I mean by explicit, not salacious. So for example, I was doing a reading in Portland of a new essay that is not released to the public. But it has a couple of encounters in it. And I am very straightforward about sort of what happens in those encounters. And then afterward, people would say, oh, you should really submit your erotic material to blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, I just thought I was telling you about my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way in which talking about sex and sexuality is still important to me because it's still seen as this pornographic image, especially being a sexualized person.
Mm-hmm.
There are these ways of just talking about, yes, well, it may be frankly sexual. It is not like your masturbation fantasy. Like, that's not what I'm here for. And I guess, you know, you do with it what you want to, but it's like you missed the fucking point because everything I was saying in that was about female friendship and how lonely I am.
So thank you so much for this conversation. It's been so great to have a venue to be able to ask each other these intimate questions. I'm secretly hopeful that people everywhere will start to ask each other these kinds of questions. But in any case, I just feel really delighted that we locked ourselves in a closet and did it today.
Literally, we're in the closet.
Literally in my closet. I am also wondering if you'd play us one of your tracks.
Absolutely.
Please.
This is The Long Hill by Clifford Grimes.
A while ago.
This has been Bitchconoclast, a mother-daughter conversation around sex, feminism, and power. I'm Sonia Lee.
And I'm Dylan Nicole Bandy.
Thanks so much for listening to season one.
We'll be back in 2018 with our second season. In the meantime, visit our website, bitchconoclast.com, and sign up for announcements on readings, events, and more coming to a town near you. If you'd like to support us, you can go to patreon.com and make a donation to help keep us going. We're producing, hosting, editing, and marketing this podcast all on our own with the help of a few friends. If you like what you hear, rate this podcast on iTunes, like Bitchconoclast on Facebook and Instagram, sign up for our newsletter, and get in touch. Get in touch with us with your thoughts and questions. Thank you again, and until next time.
On the road again.
I just can't wait.
To get on.
That's my part.
That's just, again.
Just can't wait.
Thanks for tuning in. See you next time.